Chapter 13. Introduction to the Olivet Discourse. All three synoptic Gospels give detailed accounts of the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24-25, Mark 13, and Luke 21. Footnote. Some of the material from Matthew 24 has parallels in Luke 17, which will be discussed presently. End footnote. The discourse is so named due to the venue where it was delivered, on the slopes of the Mount of Olives. It was uttered only a few days before Christ's crucifixion and predicted the destruction of the Herodian temple in Jerusalem, which was razed to the ground as Jesus predicted by the Romans in AD 70. This fulfillment of the prophecy was recognized by the early church at least as early as the Christian historian Eusebius, AD 325. It is hard to miss this identification of its fulfillment, since Jesus unambiguously predicted that not one stone of the temple structure would be left standing upon another. All would be thrown down by invaders. He also predicted that this would occur in this generation. The fulfillment occurred just 40 years after he spoke these words. The predictions in this discourse, therefore, comprise the most specific and accurate time-sensitive prophecies in the New Testament. Not all Christians have paid sufficient attention to the wording of the prophecy, or know enough about the historical facts of the case to recognize that what Jesus predicted actually occurred in the past, during the Jewish War and its bloody conclusion, AD 66 through 70. Christ's use of Jewish idioms and apocalyptic language in parts of the discourse befuddles many people who have never studied such literature. For example, dispensationalists believe that the abomination of desolation, mentioned in Matthew 24:25 and Mark 13:14, refers to some event remaining to be fulfilled in the end times. They usually associate it with a future Antichrist expected to erect a statue of himself inside a future third Jewish temple, an event to which no verse of Scripture bears testimony. Footnote. The idea that there will be an image of Antichrist set up in a future Jerusalem temple is derived by making several gratuitous assumptions and conflating two unrelated passages of Scripture. In 2 Thessalonians 2, 3-4, Paul says the man of lawlessness will sit in the temple of God. The expression temple of God is never used by Paul in reference to the Jewish temple, but he uses it elsewhere as a reference to the church, 1 Corinthians 3:16 and 2 Corinthians 6:16. In a different place, another entity called the second beast is said to create a statue of the first beast to be worshipped by all, Revelation 13, 14-15. Nothing in Scripture identifies Paul's man of lawlessness with Revelation's beast. There is no reference to an image in a temple. The man of lawlessness himself, not a statue of him, is said to sit in the temple of God. That is, in Paul's terminology, in the church. Whereas the image of the beast is worshipped by the world, but is nowhere associated with any temple or geographic region. Thus, the popular interpretation of the abomination of desolation is a composite picture put together from pieces of separate puzzles. Daniel and Jesus both provide sufficient details to identify what this term is referring to. See discussion in the next chapter, at Luke 21:20. End footnote. The easiest way to disprove a future abomination of desolation is to simply set Luke's version of the Olivet Discourse alongside the versions of the same prophecy in the other Gospels. Matthew and Mark both retain the strange Hebraism, abomination of desolation. However, in the very place where this phrase should occur in Luke, we find it paraphrased as Jerusalem surrounded by armies, Luke 21:20, which preceded by no great interval the destruction of the temple. There is also the passage in Matthew 24, 29-31, predicting the darkening of sun and moon, the falling of the stars, the sign of the Son of Man appearing in the heavens, the mourning of the tribes, the coming of the Son of Man, the additional sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and the angels gathering the elect. This passage presents as many problems for the modern reader as does the abomination of desolation. Many of the details in this section, if taken literally, would speak of the end of the universe and the wrapping up of the purposes of God in history. Yes, if taken literally. there is a growing awareness among studious Christians that all of these details can be cross-referenced with the same kind of apocalyptic language in symbolic Old Testament passages about the historical doom of nations like Edom, Egypt, and Babylon in the ancient past. Some seemingly supernatural events and visions among the Jews are recorded in Josephus's history and in parts of Scripture as occurring before Jerusalem fell. More will be said on this before we are finished. Suffice it to say that the insistence on taking this passage literally can only come from one's being insufficiently familiar with the prophetic language of the Old Testament, and possibly also with the historical eyewitness record of Josephus. To make a long story short, it will be given longer treatment below, it is possible to demonstrate that Jesus was completely correct in saying that some of his own contemporaries would live to see the events in this discourse. All partial and full preterists recognize the relevance of Christ's monologue to the Jewish war and the fall of Jerusalem. However, there exists one great difference of opinion between full preterists and some partial preterists, the latter suggesting that AD 70 is not the only subject addressed in the discourse, particularly in Matthew's longer version, in his chapters 24 and 25. Footnote. Some partial preterists agree with the full preterists that the Olivet Discourse is entirely about the fall of Jerusalem, while disagreeing with the grand thesis that all prophecy in the whole Bible was fulfilled at that time. In other words, they are full preterists with respect to the discourse, but not with respect to the Bible as a whole. End footnote. The theory held by this latter group, myself included, purports that everything prior to Matthew 24:34, with the possible exception of parenthetical insertions, occurred in the events of AD 66 through 70. Summarizing the events predicted in this early section, Jesus said, "This generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." Verse 34. We need look no later than AD 70 for his referent. Yet, in the following verse, verse 35, Jesus may be introducing a separate topic. He predicts the passing away of heaven and earth, followed by the statement, "But of that day and hour no one knows." The things that follow this transitional statement are things which actually did not occur in or prior to AD 70, and which, as this theory argues, are most reasonably applied to the future parousia at the end of the world. This analysis is stridently denied by the full preterists, who dutifully stick to their governing prejudice concerning all prophecy, and defend an AD 70 fulfillment for the entire discourse. Matthew 24:1-35 follows quite closely, thought for thought, alongside Mark 13 and Luke 21. After verse 35, Matthew 24 contains material found in neither of Mark's or Luke's parallel accounts, but some of which is found in a different discourse recorded in Luke 17:22-37. Matthew's additional material from verse 36 through chapter 25 seems to speak of Christ's future second coming. Matthew extends the discourse with five additional parables not found in Mark or Luke. The discourse in Luke 17, from which Matthew 24 draws some of its later material, was spoken on a different occasion from that of the Olivet Discourse in Luke 21, and may well be about a different subject. This latter point is what is disputed among preterists. Matthew seems to have combined portions of two separate discourses. As it is his general custom to conflate similar sayings of Christ into composite discourses elsewhere, for example, Matthew chapters 5 through 7, chapter 10, chapter 13, and chapter 18, there seems little doubt that this is what he has done in Matthew 24 through 25. The relevant questions would be, 1. Are the two discourses in Luke 17 and Luke 21 both addressing the same theme? And 2, if not, why did Matthew combine them? On the first question, the full preterist argues that both discourses are on the same theme, meaning the whole of Matthew's conflation of the two should be interpreted as having to do with AD 70. By contrast, some partial preterists are inclined to see Luke 17 as the outlier, which is not about AD 70, but rather about the parousia at the end of the world. If so, then part of Matthew 24 should be applied to AD 70, roughly that portion paralleling Mark 13 and Luke 21, and the other part should be interpreted as relating to the still future second coming of Christ. On this assumption, why did Matthew combine these two discourses of Christ? If the full preterist's answer to the first question is correct, namely, that both of Luke's passages are about AD 70, it becomes unproblematic. Matthew simply combined the material from two sermons about the impending destruction of Jerusalem. However, the easiest solution is not necessarily the correct one. If the alternative view is correct, and Luke 17 is about the future end of the present age, then several possible reasons for combining discourses on two different subjects may be considered. 1. Matthew, writing as he did before the fall of Jerusalem, may have assumed that the two discourses were about the same subject, a mistake that could not have been discovered until after AD 70, when the events of Luke 17 did not materialize. 2. Matthew knew they were about two different events, but considered that they might occur in close proximity to each other. No one, not even Jesus, knew the date of the second event. But in the absence of information to the contrary, Matthew and all New Testament writers may well have expected the second coming to occur at roughly the same time as the destruction of Jerusalem, or soon thereafter. No one could fault Matthew for having such an opinion. And if he did, it would make sense for him to combine these two discourses as he did. 3. Matthew knew they were two different subjects, but placed them together topically, since both are protracted judgment narratives in the teachings of Christ. Judgment would then be the common theme of both, though they were not about the same judgment. This would be analogous to what Matthew did in conflating multiple discourses about the disciples' short-term mission in Galilee and their long-range mission to the world, respectively. The first 15 verses of Matthew 10 contain instructions Jesus gave to his disciples on the occasion of sending them out two by two to Galilean villages on a short-term outreach. Compare Matthew 10:1-15 with Luke 9:1-6. In the following verses, Matthew adds to the chapter things Jesus said on later occasions concerning other, much later, outreaches. Compare Matthew 10:16-22 with Luke 21:12-19 and Matthew 10:26-33 with Luke 12:2-9. Matthew follows the same policy with his expanded versions of the Sermon on the Mount. Compare Matthew 5-7 with Luke 6:20 and following, and the parable's discourse in Matthew 13. This, then, is where the disagreement lies between the full and partial preterists on the Olivet Discourse. The best way to analyze the question would seem to be to examine the three synoptic accounts side by side, verse by verse. It is only by doing so that the meaning of certain obscure statements becomes elucidated. That is what we will do in our next chapter. In comparing Matthew 24 with Mark 13 and Luke 21, we find the parallel portion of these chapters can be divided into 19 pericopes, or subject units. Matthew includes a couple of major data points in parallel with Luke 17, which were actually not part of Jesus' discourse on the Mount of Olives. After including these two additional pericopes, Matthew reconnects with Mark and Luke in concluding with warnings to quote-unquote watch. Here are the first 19 segments paralleled in the Olivet Discourse. 1. The prediction of destruction, Matthew 24:1-2, Mark 13:1-2, Luke 21:5-6. 2. The disciples' question, Matthew 24:3, Mark 13:3-4, Luke 21:7. 3. False messiahs, Matthew 24:4-5, Mark 13:5-6, Luke 21:8. 4. Initial wars, Matthew 24:6, Mark 13:7, Luke 21:9. 5. Disasters, the beginning of sorrows, Matthew 24:7-8, Mark 13:8, Luke 21:10. 6. Persecution and false prophets, Matthew 24:9-12, Mark 13:9-13, Luke 21:12-18. 7. Endurance necessary, Matthew 24:13, Mark 13:13, Luke 21:19. 8. Gospel preached to all nations, Matthew 24:14, Mark 13:10. 9. Abomination of desolation, Matthew 24:15, Mark 13:14, Luke 21:20. 10. Flight to the mountains, Matthew 24:17-18, Mark 13:14-16, Luke 21:21-22. 11. Woe to those with encumbrances, Matthew 24:19-20, Mark 13:17-18, Luke 21:23. 12. Tribulation. Matthew 24:21-22, Mark 13:19-20, Luke 21:23-26. 13. Premature claims of Messiah's return. Matthew 24:23-28, Mark 13:21-23, Luke 17:22-25. 14. After tribulation. Matthew 24:29, Mark 13:24-25, Luke 21:26. 15. Son of Man coming. Matthew 24:30-31, Mark 13:26-27, Luke 21:27-28. 16. Fig tree analogy. Matthew 24:32-33, Mark 13:28-29, Luke 21:29-31. 17. This generation. Matthew 24:34, Mark 13:30, Luke 21:32. 18. Heaven and earth will pass away. Matthew 24:35, Mark 13:31, Luke 21:33. 19. The unknown day and hour. Matthew 24:36, Mark 13:32. We will look at each of these points more closely in the next chapter, but the general observation I would make initially is that we find parallels in all three accounts of the Olivet Discourse through the first 19 subject sections. Luke omits the last point, but Mark includes it. Matthew 24 continues beyond this point by including two major additional sections, paralleled in a different context in Luke, before merging again with the other accounts in the closing warning to watch. 20. Days of Noah, Matthew 24:37-39, Luke 17:26-30. 21. One taken, one left, Matthew 24:40-41, Luke 17:34-37. 22. The need to watch. Matthew 24:42-44, Mark 13:33-37, Luke 21:34-36. Mark 13 and Luke 21 rejoin Matthew, or he rejoins them, and they conclude the discourse. All accounts end with an emphasis on the need for diligence and watching for the return of the Lord at an unpredictable and unexpected time. The need to watch refers to staying awake, which is appropriate whatever the time may be, whether in anticipation of AD 70 or of the final judgment at the Parousia. Therefore, the final exhortation does not connect exclusively with either of the two events, but applies to both. Among the three accounts of the discourse, Matthew is alone in inserting points 20 and 21. However, as we have mentioned, we find the parallels to these in Luke 17, which we think to be looking forward to the final parousia, rather than the downfall of the Jewish temple and society. If this is so, then we would be entitled to postulate the following understanding of the discourse. 1. Mark 13 and Luke 21 are answering the question of the disciples about the time of the fall of Jerusalem, and are therefore looking toward AD 70. This discussion climaxes with the summary statement that this event would be fulfilled in their own generation, Matthew 24:34, Mark 13:30, Luke 21:32. Matthew 24:1-34 parallels them thus far. 2. After this summary statement, Matthew and Mark record Jesus predicting that heaven and earth will pass away, followed by his remark that no one knows the day or the hour of that event, Matthew 24:35 and Mark 13:31. This means that Jesus gave a time reference for the fall of Jerusalem, but was unable to give any information about the time of the passing away of heaven and earth, which Peter and Revelation place at the time of the Parousia. 3. Matthew seems to use this last statement as a springboard from which to launch into material on this new topic, which Jesus here introduces without further comment, but about which he had taught elsewhere, that is, in Luke 17, and on other occasions not paralleled in other Gospels, that is, the parables of Matthew 25. This all may sound very neat and tidy, but it is not without its difficulties. Full preterist Ed Stevens is among those who have challenged this framework for understanding Matthew 24. He points out that there are parallels with Luke 17 not only in Matthew's later section, but also in his earlier section, suggesting that Luke 17, like Matthew 24's earlier portion, is also about AD 70. Luke 17 should not then be thought of as addressing a different topic. Stevens calls attention to five details in the Luke 17 passage, three of which are found in Matthew's earlier portion, the part I have identified with an AD 70 fulfillment, and two of them included in Matthew's later section, that which I have identified with the eschatological parousia. Since the AD 70 portion of Matthew 24 contains elements of Luke 17, it is argued the latter passage must also be seen as having a fulfillment in the destruction of Jerusalem. This strikes me as a formidable argument, if not for the existence of even greater arguments against his thesis. The two points of similarity between Luke 17 and the later section of Matthew 24, the days of Noah and the one taken, one left passages, would support my thesis, if not for the challenge presented by the other three bits. What are they? In Luke 17 and in the early portion of Matthew 24, we find the following three parallels. 1. Let him who was on the housetop not come down, Matthew 24:17 and following with Luke 17:31. 2. For as the lightning comes from the east, Matthew 24:26 and following, with Luke 17:23 and following. 3. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered, Matthew 24:28, with Luke 17:37. Since all of these features appear in the section of Matthew 24 that discusses AD 70, by what tortured logic, we are asked, can they be said to be about something else when they appear in Luke 17? How shall we address this challenge? As for the first of these three, I will confess that it has always provided difficulties for me. We will temporarily table that point to be discussed presently. The other two points do not present a problem at all. On the assumption that Luke 17 is talking about the yet future parousia of Christ, sayings number 2 and number 3 must both address that event. Matthew places them together as adjacent statements, but in what context? Here are the verses in their context. Then if anyone says to you, "Look, here is the Christ," or "there," do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, "Look, he is in the desert," do not go out. Or, "Look, he is in the inner rooms," do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. We see that Matthew presents these two statements as a corrective to anticipated false rumors that might circulate prior to AD 70 asserting that Messiah has secretly or invisibly returned, verses 23 through 26. With reference to such reports, he says, "Don't believe it." The same warning is found in the parallel in Mark 13:21-23. However, Matthew alone inserts these two additional statements into his record in which, borrowing from Luke 17, he parenthetically tells the reader that Jesus' actual return will be universally observed and not secretive, as the rumors would be falsely claiming. In both Matthew and Mark's versions of the discourse, Jesus issued a warning not to be deceived by false reports of Christ's having secretly returned. At this point, Matthew inserts the specific corrective, telling us that the actual return of Christ will be accompanied by unmistakable evidences, like the illumination of the sky, or like telltale eagles, or possibly vultures. The details borrowed from Luke 17 address the future second coming, but are inserted parenthetically by Matthew as a corrective in a relevant spot in his narration about AD 70. Matthew wants his readers to know what the second coming will really be like, so he tells them by importing information not spoken by Jesus on that particular occasion, but on another. This is not even slightly problematic, and is keeping with Matthew's general policy of expanding Christ's recorded discourses with authentic sayings of Christ given on other occasions about the similar topics. But what about the first problem? Christ's exhortation not to return to one's house. In Matthew 24, it functions as placing additional stress on the urgent need to leave the city of Jerusalem as the Romans approached. See especially Luke's parallel in Luke 21:20 and following. But how could the same words in Luke 17 relate to the end of the world? Much less obviously, I will confess. To my mind, this is the only minor speed bump in our identification of Luke 17 with the final parousia, but is it fatal to the thesis? Each reader must judge, especially as we will soon examine the fatal flaws in the only alternative, which is the identification of Luke 17 with AD 70. Here is how it reads in Luke 17. In that day, he who is on the housetop, and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. Verses 31 through 33. If in that day refers to the sudden appearance of Christ, accompanied by the burning up of the cosmos, how does it make sense to tell people not to attempt to rescue their goods from within their house? If that cataclysm occurs in the twinkling of an eye, how would anyone have time even to consider doing this? And to where could they be planning to flee anyway? A reasonable answer might be that these three verses do not actually command any action to be taken at all, only what not to do, but merely make a point of principle about attitudes toward worldly things. Notice in Matthew 24 these words about going back to the house are connected with the command to flee. In Luke 17, there is no such instruction about flight. In fact, there is no specific instruction at all, only the idea of abandoning all attachment to worldly possessions. Along with the following two verses, verse 31 may be seen as merely an idiomatic way of warning against maintaining any bondage to the things of this world, including your clothing, your household possessions, or your life. The statement about Lot's wife suggests that we should not have a longing for the society nor the possessions of the condemned world that we are leaving behind. Seeking to save our lives in this world would simply disqualify us for the life to which we are going. Seen this way, the exhortation in Luke 17 is not actually the same as that similar statement in Matthew 24:16-18, Mark 13:14-16, and Luke 21:21. The latter referring specifically to the urgency of fleeing from the doomed city. No actual flight is here mentioned in Luke 17, only the need for detachment from the world, so there is no reason to attach the words in Luke to the necessary flight in Matthew 24. The final warning forbidding the seeking to save one's own life underscores that this is not referring in Luke 17 to escaping from Jerusalem. Would not such a flight be the quintessential example in such a situation of trying to save one's own life? The command to flee in Matthew 24 is clearly with a mind of the disciples seeking to save their lives. I will advise the reader to withhold judgment on the strength and validity of this explanation until we have examined the problems associated with the only alternative to this theory. We will conduct that investigation in the course of our verse-by-verse commentary on the discourse in the next chapter.